Welcome to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains. I'm Corby Skinner.
And I'm Anna Page. And we're sharing stories of creative people who live and work in the Intermountain West. Corby, interesting that for our first radio show, we focused on two visual art forms, sculpture and dance.
So we are going to have to hear about those art forms. And our first interview is with Tracy Linder and Phoebe Knapp Warren, who are sculptors that will be showing this week in the art auction at the Yellowstone Art Museum.
And I was able to sit down with Ricky Feely, who founded Terpsichore Dance Company of Montana, and two dancers in that company, Christina Taylor and Kate Blakesley, to talk about their upcoming performance at the Babcock this weekend.
So let's go to Tracy Linder and Phoebe Knapp Warren's conversation on Resounds. I am delighted to have Tracy Linder and Phoebe Knapp in the studio with us today. We are previewing the Yellowstone Art Center's art auction, which will be Saturday, March 4th. And both of you have pieces in the auction and have had work in the auction for a long time. So let's just get into some of the nitty-gritty about your work. The first thing that I noticed that I really love is that both of you have agricultural backgrounds. Phoebe, you have a big ranch in Fort Smith. Tracy, you grew up on a ranch in Moult. And I'm very interested how that ranching history influences your work. Phoebe, do you want to take that first?
Sure. My grandfather was an innovative engineer and wheat farmer south of Hardin. My mother, an architect, continued this family farming operation. And now I continue to both ranch in the area and work as a sculptor. This ag background has influenced my work in many ways. Problem solving, risk taking, but with a practical application, work ethic, study of scale, understanding of materials and overall concepts, sense of space, ability to fix things, think on feet, follow through no matter the challenge, and be alone. And finally, closeness to the natural world.
Ah, interesting. Now, your studio is in downtown Billings.
Correct.
And your ranch is actually
in
on
Fort
the
Smith.
Bighorn River.
Correct.
Right. So I just wanted to add, I've seen Phoebe's work in her studio, in galleries, but I've also seen it out on the ranch, which is a really interesting perspective of how that work relates to land.
Thank you, Corby.
Tracy, you grew up in a ranch in Moult, and your work is very much tied into the agricultural community. Do you want to talk about that?
Sure. And I did. I grew up actually west of Billings is where the farm was. And it was a small family farm, and I was fortunate to have one sister. So because there were no brothers, we really got brought up in all aspects of farming. So as much as we were in the house and doing the gardening and all of the traditional women's roles, we were doing the men's roles as well. And so, you know, my parents were great in including us in all aspects of farming. So we'd be out on tractors, irrigating, running irrigation tubes and all of the different things. And harvest was always such a great, fun time. My dad just truly loved harvest. So we just had a blast during all of our harvests. So, you know, really great memories. But what Phoebe brought up about the work ethic and having to problem solve and be creative in all aspects of your life translates so well into being an artist.
You know what I was just thinking?
Absolutely.
Isn't it interesting that work gives you time to think? Mm. I mean, sometimes the most mundane sort of work really allows you to think creatively. I want to say for the listeners, the fact that Tracy and Phoebe have agricultural backgrounds, I want you to be sure that the work is not pictures of ducks or cows, or their work is very modern, very sculptural. And I'm interested in how you go about choosing the material. We'll get to that. But first, let's talk a little bit about the difference between narrative artwork, a painting of a pond with ducks, or a painting of deer going through the forest. Both of your work is narrative, but it's not pictorial. So can you talk a little bit about that? Phoebe, why don't you start?
I'll say something. My work doesn't show a literal picture, but evokes a narrative of discovery, or something not necessarily brought forward, said, thought, or solved before. So I guess as a narrative, I don't see it literally so, any more than I see it as a picture.
Mm-hmm. And some of your work has sort of gate-like.
Or a portal.
Into
another, or an oculus, or however you want to look at it, looking into another.
So, and Tracy, your work is interesting in that you often use very familiar objects, but in very unusual ways, whether it's gloves or hay, coats. Do you want to talk a little bit about how your work uses sort of visual elements, but translates that?
Sure. And I wanted to kind of dovetail onto what Phoebe was saying, too. I think both of us approach our work to invite dialogue, to have conversation. So we're not just displaying an idea we had or an image that was in our heads. We're really trying to relate with our audience and spark something new, have a conversation.
Absolutely.
So in my experiences growing up on a farm and trying to have a conversation about what's happening with today's farming and our food sources, I feel like it's really important to use some of that familiar, iconic imagery, but kind of strip it bare down so that you can start seeing it in a new way.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm, you know, very careful. We're going to talk about materials. So I'm very careful in the material I use, in the scale I use, and repetition seems to be common throughout my work. And that I think that that really comes from the repetitive nature of seasons and the repetitive nature of farming, of driving a tractor up and down the field.
Or 100 cows.
Yes,
is
exactly.
Not a lot of cows on a farm, but 100 cows in an art gallery or 100 heads is a lot. So, let's talk a little bit about material, because both of you use material in such interesting ways. And I always think of Michelangelo when he talked about a piece of marble and he saw the sculpture inside and his job was to let the sculpture come out. How do you go about it? Do you find material and then work sculpture out of the material? Or do you have an idea and then find the material to convey that idea?
The materials I use are mostly organic, i.e. wood. But they're often used in conjunction with metal, stone, or glass. So the egg mostly comes first because of the materials available. But I can have a concept, the chicken, in mind, and then look around for the material, the egg.
Mm-hmm. You do massive wood pieces, too, sculptural pieces. Where do you find that sort of material?
Well, I have to procure where I can. And that's why I've been to the Yak and back.
Mm-hmm. And walnut doesn't grow along.
No. Yeah. I've had the kindness of many ranchers and farmers who've had trees or whatnot. And then I was lucky to get extraordinary cache of old walnut trees from California.
Oh, wonderful.
Right, which was my incredible mother load of material in my lifetime.
Right. And Tracy, you use, again, some original materials. I keep thinking of your glove series, the workman coat series, and then sort of transform that. Talk a little bit about the materials that you use in your work.
Well, I think all of my work is really content-driven, but to get it to say and feel the way I want it to, I really look for those unusual materials, or actually oftentimes very common materials, and translate them in a new way that hopefully has more of a profound impact. So when I go out searching for materials for a specific thing, it so often happens that it'll be 2 or 3 years before I figure out really why I was attracted to that material. So I always have a combination going of ideas in my head and materials that I'm attracted to, and what does that combination of those two things really then end up being? And, you know, one of the favorite phrases I learned in grad school was every material has a memory. So if you look at those gloves, those leather gloves, I mean, the memory in each glove is, you know, can be mind-boggling and really give you a sense of how much labor that one glove had. But when I approached that work, I was also thinking of the animal that that glove came from. So it was a skin in its beginning life and protected the animal, whether it was calf or pig or deer. And then in this second lifespan, it's protecting human hands.
Do you know what I found interesting when I was researching both of you? You both have used very organic things, but recently both of you have been doing bronze.
Phoebe had
a really large bronze piece, and I'll ask you about that. And then Tracy, congratulations. I saw your calf piece that you just submitted to an art auction. So where did the bronze come from?
Interesting. We have both been curious, but have been had struggled to decide to use bronze for many reasons, because the organic nature of our materials and the history involved and all the things that made us attracted to those materials. And bronze is a different deal, but it also has its qualities of permanency, especially for outdoor use. So we both kind of took the bull by the horns and went for it.
It's always been a tool in the bag of things that we could make our work out of. But it was when I made that first calf and got it in clay form and looked at it, and I went, oh, this one needs to be in bronze. And the reasons were, really, so much of my work is about making something really strong, steel into wax, or, you know, making something vulnerable that's typically not seen as vulnerable. And in this moment, I have this very vulnerable calf, so it made sense to make it into a strong, impermeable material.
Sort of the opposite of your see-through blades from a tractor. So that's interesting. I have one final question that I didn't prime you with earlier that I'm going to put out there. And what made me think about it is, Tracy, I watched your TED Talk that you did at the library maybe a year ago. And it was a lot about nutrition and nurturing and where our food comes from and understanding all of that. And I kept thinking, let's talk about nurturing and how art does that for you and how important art is to feed the body and the soul.
Wow.
That's kind of a heavy question, I know.
Just leave that for the last. Well, I think it sort of depends if we're looking at it as creators or as onlookers. As a creator, I think having that opportunity to have a workspace where you can go in there and be shut off from the world in whatever way you want to be shut off, or connected however you want to be connected, but to give yourself that space to just be whole and focused on what your work is about, and to get into your materials and the rhythm of making the work, really, I probably is therapeutic in many ways, and probably then allows us to self-nurture in so many ways. But there's also the opportunity to go and see work and read and listen to great music, and, you know, all of the different arts combined truly do feed me.
I always think I'm sort of a dabbler in the arts.
No, Corby, that's so, not true.
Well, I love drawing and painting. And because I'm in public relations, I'm always dealing with words and conversation. And when I sit down to do a drawing and I'm working with line, color, and shape that don't have that same sort of structure, it's so comforting. I mean, there is something that when you're working with organic matter or shapes, that frees you in a way.
That's right. That's right. It's very difficult to put your art into words because it's not words.
And I always think really good art speaks for itself.
Precisely. I was just going to say that.
And we would always like to fall back on that.
Yes.
Well, then you have been very brave being my first interviewers.
Like, you, Corby.
I didn't bring a writer in, but I brought in two sculptors. Well, thank you, Phoebe Knapp Warren, Tracy Linder. Their work can be seen at the Yellowstone Art Center now. The auction is March 4th, Saturday, March 4th, and keep working. Tracy, before I forget, your website is?
TracyLinder.com.
And PhoebeKnapp.com. So I encourage listeners to check out their work. It's always hard to talk about art. So if you go to the website, you can see what we've been talking about. Thank you.
Corby.
Thank you, Corby.
I'm really excited to be joined today by some of the members of Terpsichore, which is a Montana-based dance troupe. We've got Ricky Feely, who is the founder of Terpsichore, and two dancers of the company, Christina Taylor and Kate Blakesley. Thanks for being here with me today.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, it's very
Thank
exciting.
You.
We're glad to get a chance to talk to you. You're working on your upcoming spring performance, and this word is such a beautiful word, Hyraeth.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about Hyraeth and the concept behind this word.
So Hyraeth is described as a homesickness for a home to which you cannot return, or a home that maybe never was. The nostalgia, the yearning, and the grief for lost places of your past.
This scenic tour of dance, music, poetry, art, you're really exploring that visceral connection between women and nature. When you go to choreograph something like Hyraeth, how do you start to concept the connection to nature?
My cousin Naomi Atkins and I wanted to create a piece about how women connect to nature and how we too are strong in our connection to nature. And then it just kind of evolved to how is a woman's connection to nature different from a male perspective? And we started working on a duet together, her and I, called Styrke, which is Norwegian for strength. And I just kind of went outside in my backyard and started to choreograph just on how I was feeling being out in nature and based on the music that she had created of how she interpreted her strength that she finds with a communing with nature. Then it just kind of evolved from there, and I reached out to my dancers and fellow artists, and we kept evolving it into more and more themes. So we've ended up with a chapter book, if you will, that our show is based off of the chapters that we found had meaning and that we connected to as women.
The work is incredibly elemental. When I was watching you rehearse and looking at some of these chapters, it felt like there's all the evolutions of the planet within it. You have this connection to water, this rebirth through fire, this tie to dust and to the salt and the sea. It's mm-hmm. a very lovely and very organic piece that is in, is it 20 parts you're stitching together?
Yes, I believe there's about 20 pieces. We have little solos that are interludes, so it's probably even more than that. The chapters are broken down into these elements, and then under those chapters fall several dances at a time.
In observing how you've put them together, the first half of the show seems to be almost rooted in childhood, in our exploration of nature as children, and that place of refuge that you might be able to find as a young child underneath an apple tree or by staring at your reflection in the water.
Mm-hmm.
And then into more of that adulthood where we begin to experience loss and longing and all of these really visceral, natural parts of our world. There are elements of loss within this work, of birth and rebirth and death. Tell me how you use dance as a medium to communicate such complex emotions.
I'll pipe in. As an observer of a piece that I'm not in, titled Refugee, and it's a comment and a storyline on the current situation worldwide going on with refugees. I think as dancers, there are situations we find ourselves that we aren't able to process fully or speak about or do anything about, really, that we can see and connect with these larger ideas. And so we dance about them. And this piece has been a beautiful way, even as an observer, for me to process some of the really deep things going on worldwide and to notice. And I think as the dancers in that, for them to be able to process that and be a part of that process is one of the ways that we as dancers can do things about, you know, concepts in the world or process these larger ideas that we otherwise wouldn't have the means to communicate about.
Yeah, what a good point, Christina, that movement becomes something that words maybe cannot convey. Kate, yeah. What's your connection with these different pieces?
I guess I would echo Christina in saying that it's interesting that we're all on the radio because words sometimes are hard maybe for our personalities. And it's interesting to be able to delve into ideas about the origins of women and the earth, maybe something that I've never spent a lot of time dialoguing out or thinking about in the context of words, but now I have an opportunity to do it. For example, in the opening piece of the show is a representation of women as like a wolf pack, an idea of us being strong and caring for each other, but also deeply fierce and survivor, the idea of that, and being able to kind of put myself in that in a way I've never considered before, right? In a way I've never talked about, but now I'm suddenly experiencing it and feeling it and finding new connection to it, I guess.
The vision of all of you coming out onto stage as a wolf pack, it's a really powerful image, and to be able to use your bodies in those kinds of ways to explore those concepts. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we get to do it both physically, like literally. You'll see some of the movements are really representative of the things wolves do, like howl, not with our voices, but with our bodies, or move our tails, or flick our ears, those types of things that wolves do. You'll see some representation of that in the physical movement, but also then just the idea, the concept of the 11 of us. You know, we spend a lot of time together. We do a lot of heavy things together, like dialogue and cry about refugees, like Christina's saying, mm-hmm. and dialogue and consider the loss that we've all experienced in life in different avenues. And so then getting together, the 11 of us, to represent that idea of a wolf pack, that we are connected, we look out for each other, we care for each other, we, you know, do those really matronly things that you sometimes see a wolf pack doing, like hugging and taking each other in underneath your arm. We get to do that, maybe not so literally, mm-hmm. also. It's fun.
I'm intrigued by the idea that dancers are taught to be silent. Dance is a form of expression that doesn't have a lot of voice to it, yet your work has so many voices. It's incredibly collaborative. You're bringing a sketch artist, you're bringing live music and poetry voice. So this multidisciplinary approach, how does it change the work from that traditionally silent dancer role?
I think that Ricky does a really great job of using music like that. If you've been to our shows before, you've seen her voice in that. That music can really convey that emotion in addition to what you're seeing on the stage. You know, you listen to something and it really makes your heart feel like a fist, like it's gonna well up inside of you. She has, I think, always done a great job of that. And so I think that now that we're adding poets and other images into it, it just amplifies the opportunity for there to be a voice heard. Especially dance is maybe something that not everyone in our community has seen or know how to interpret. Mm-hmm. And so when you add these other elements, like we're doing this year, someone who maybe can't identify with the dance element of it could easily identify with, oh, that musical piece really spoke to me in this way, or it made me feel X or Y. Or same with the poetry element, you know, that's maybe a different avenue for people to connect to the idea that we're communicating.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that incorporating the artists that are of other disciplines helps us convey our idea to our audience and helps our audience to be able to connect with us and stay with us on this journey. We're trying to create an environment. And so when they walk into the theater and sit down, I want them to forget that they're sitting in a theater and just go on this journey with all of us. And we also have photography by Mary Kate Teske that's going to be projected in the background with time-lapse videos of nature, of flowers dying, of the celestial skies, of rivers. And so it's just going to add a whole other element of creating the space for us where, you know, we wish we could take our audience to those places live, but we're going to try to take them there visually, and hopefully they can feel the visceral connection that we're displaying of women's connection to nature, that they'll be able to feel that sitting in their chairs.
There's so much grace on the stage. There's so much trust. When I watch you guys perform at the rehearsal the other night, one of your youngest members was being lifted and everyone was surrounding her saying, it's okay, you know, you can lean back further, lean back. And you could just see her letting go and trusting completely in the women below her to catch her.
Mm-hmm.
What a beautiful metaphor for what you're doing in Terpsichore, which is just putting trust on display. Kate, Christina, how have you guys watched and witnessed Terpsichore evolve and been part of it?
Well, this is my second season with Terpsichore. I recently moved to Billings, and this whole show and gathering of women and being connected and strong has definitely lived out in my short time with Terpsichore, in that I moved here and didn't know anybody and hadn't had any dance experience or connections here, and all of a sudden I showed up at Terpsichore and I have 10 new best friends, and all of the things that you do in dance kind of expedite the friendship process. You must trust each other. You can't be afraid to touch each other. You're close, in close quarters. You know, no one's running around with makeup on, and you see each other at your best and your worst, and you're all working together to be your best and further your talents and things. And so that has been interesting for me, that you just, even last year and this year are vastly different in the people that we have dancing with us, but the connection is the same. So the evolution of being a more cohesive group, you know, definitely evolves, but the concept is the same, that we are women who like to dance and, you know, put ideas out there through movement. And whether on the stage or in life, we have a really strong connection, a physical and an emotional connection to each other. And that's been really fun to experience, even in my short time with the company.
And Kate, you've been with the company for quite a while, haven't you?
I joined in 2012.
Okay.
So a couple of years after they formed. And I remember watching them in their first seasons from, you know, the back rows of the Babcock Theater, thinking, oh man, I have to do this. I have to be a part. And I knew a lot of them growing up dancing in Billings. We grew up dancing together. But there was something about just storytelling together in a way that I knew I had to jump in. And so, yeah, since 2012, I've been a part of the group and grown a lot and changed a lot. And something that I think is really amazing about this season that we're going to do is what you're going to see in our March show is one long story. I think that's something that we haven't done a lot of before. If you've seen us dance in the past, you've seen one dance, and that's the conclusion of that story or that mood or that metaphor that's being told. And then the lights go black, the new music starts, and it's a new story. It's a new, you know, a new piece of music, a new emotion. What you'll see with Hyraeth is from start to finish, from 7 p.m. until it's done, is one long story, in the way that we've discussed there being chapters and the story evolving, but it's still very much the same journey.
Catch Terpsichore Dance Company's presentation of Hyraeth Friday, March 3rd and Saturday, March 4th, 7 p.m. at the Babcock Theater. These shows do sell out, so get tickets in advance. I would highly recommend terpsichoredance.com. And I look forward to seeing the full novel unfolded.
Thanks for listening to the first program of Resounds. If you're in Billings this weekend, stop by the Yellowstone Art Museum for the annual art auction.
And check out Terpsichore's Hyraeth at the Babcock Theater, 7 p.m., March 3rd and 4th.
You've been listening to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains, produced by Anna Page, Corby Skinner, and Ken Siebert for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music by Alex Nauman. Hear this program anytime online at ypradio.org.